Hello and welcome to Pete's Percussion Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Zambito, and we're here for episode 112 and part two of my conversation with longtime Florida State University percussion professor John W. Parks IV. Hopefully, you've had a chance to catch part one of my conversation with John, which was released last week. And if not, get on it, where we discussed his career at FSU and the many ways his career has blossomed since getting there. This time, we trace his path up to and including his current work. So here we go. We recorded this interview over Skype on October 25th, 2018, and it begins right now.
So where did you end up growing up?
I grew up in North Carolina.
Where?
Right beside Charlotte.
Okay.
Right beside Charlotte in a little town called Gastonia.
Yeah. I know Gastonia.
You know that town?
I did my undergrad at Wake Forest and my grad work at UNC Greensboro. So I know, I've never been to Gastonia, but Gastonia always had a lot of stories.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Were you at Wake when David Levy was there?
Yeah. I mean,
David Levy is?
There. Yeah.
Yeah, he was one of my teachers from Eastman, actually.
Oh, wow.
Hold on. Get this. I just got my new copy because I let one of my students borrow it. This is the Beethoven's Ninth Aftermath book. I took a class on Beethoven 9 with him at Eastman, which is one of my favorite classes of all time.
Oh, that's awesome.
That guy is a genius.
He was my mentor in undergrad, and he was that book had just come out when I was an undergrad. And so I took a Beethoven class with him. I took music history 2 with him, from the classical on, which was my favorite class in all of undergrad. And Beethoven was a close second. He's one of my favorite people, in the music industry I've ever met.
Yeah, he's brilliant.
Yeah.
I'm absolutely first class guy.
Yeah.
And UNCG, man, what a great place. I was on faculty at EMF for a number of years.
Yeah.
And worked closely with all of them. And there's so many great people there.
Yeah, I was. I looked at that. When were you playing there?
God, it's been about 2 years, Matt Decker. Wow. Took my spot after I left, and man, talk about a great player. That dude is just amazing. Let's see. I think I was there for 4 years, so it would have been like, what year is this? 18.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have been like 14 through 16, or no, 12 through 16, something like that.
Okay. Very cool. I used to go to that. I used to work for the Wake Forest radio station, and so I got just to do it just like as a secretary essentially, but I would get through the other DJs, I'd get like free tickets to a lot of the EMF stuff. So for like 2 years I went to like 10 concerts a year, and it was incredible.
That's super fun, man. I love that place.
And it's one of my favorite places. I was always thinking that that was the perfect, if someone was not really a classical music fan, like that's the right kind of environment for them to see, like to see young kids who are like fired up about classical music, like cheering the crap out of their teachers.
Oh yeah,
it's cool.
Like one of the best environments, man. It's super fun. And John Shaw and Eric Schweikert are just fabulous percussion and timpani players. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're just amazing, and I love working with Schwartz, and that orchestra is just fabulous. So yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Do you have like any specific Gastonia stories? Because I heard a ton of them when I was an undergrad from friends of mine who grew up in the Gastonia area.
I have no Gastonia stories.
Okay.
You mean about me specifically?
No, about
the town itself?
The town of Gastonia.
No, I mean, really, the only thing that I know about it is that James Worthy went to my high school.
Oh, sweet.
I went to Ashbrook.
Okay.
And that Leonard Hamilton went to Hunter Huss, who's our basketball coach.
Okay.
And that's literally all I know. And that and like all of my best friends from high school, with very few exceptions, all still live there.
Oh, okay.
And have raised their families there. My mom still lives there.
Okay.
And so, and I'm taking my boys up there for Thanksgiving. But
oh, sweet.
That's literally all I can tell you, except that Charlotte has gotten so big,
right,
that Gastonia is basically a suburb now.
Yeah.
Whereas before, it was definitely like there was separation between, like, going to Charlotte was like a big deal,
yeah,
you know, and now it's like it's not a big deal at all. It's like if you're going to go out to dinner, then you're probably going to go to Charlotte. It's just kind of assumed.
Yeah.
But at any rate,
I was because I mean, this was back in the like mid 90s when I was at Wake Forest as an undergrad. And so we had a lot of people from that area. But a number of them were from Gastonia, and they had stories about. And this would definitely be in the part when it was not a suburb of of Charlotte. The one that stood out, and I just thought of this before we came on, was somebody said that there was some dude was trying to. So it's like partially sad and then strange, but it was like some dude was trying to commit suicide. So he went to the Gastonia airport and got a plane out of the hangar and tried to fly it, and it crashed, and he was fine. So he goes back to the hangar, gets plane number 2. Same thing, goes up, crashes, he's fine. He goes back for plane number 3, goes up, crashes, he's fine again, and then he just drops the idea of killing himself. Like,
I know exactly where that would be, because the runway, there's a big drop off at the end of the municipal airport runway that goes over the Gaston Country Club lake.
Yeah.
So there's like this, the airport runway goes down, and then there's a road right underneath it, and then it goes over, and then there's the lake for the 18th hole on the Country Club golf course.
Uh-huh.
So I know exactly where you're talking about, but I've never heard that.
Okay.
So who knows?
Yeah, right. I mean, that could be just urban legend, but apparently there were just tons of stories like that from Gastonia,
not surprising. Not surprising.
Were any of your family in the arts?
Nope.
So
not
how did
all.
You get the percussion bug?
Well, I don't think we have enough time for that. But long story short, I always liked drums, and my mom made me play piano when I was a kid, and I played all the way up through college. I actually went to college as a piano major, but I started playing drums. I always wanted to play, but my parents were afraid that I was going to end up being a heroin addict because – you know, I wanted to play drums for Journey. That's really what I wanted.
Right.
And or Rush. Like, if Neil Peart were to call it quits, you know, I thought I could step in.
Of course,
you know, no
yeah.
problem.
Yeah.
You know, in like 8th grade, you know, what did I know?
Of course.
And so they didn't think that it was such a good idea. But when I got to college, long story short, I got put in the orchestra and played bass drum on Carmina Burana. And that pretty much did it. After that, it was all over.
Yeah.
And percussion just kind of became my thing. And it took some convincing to get my parents to understand what I was going to do. And I was music ed undergrad. And I thought I was going to be a high school band director. And then I really just got so much more turned on by playing than working as a band director. And so then I went to Northwestern and I did a degree in performance. And then I did one in jazz pedagogy. And then my first job, ironically, was a director of marching band / jazz ensemble / percussion or trombone.
Okay.
So I ended up being a band director anyway, which was super fun. And God, I learned so much from that first job. It was at Sanford, where Grant Dalton is now, who's also one of my dear friends. And so I loved that job. I loved Birmingham. And I was actually getting to play almost every week with Alabama Symphony when they came back online after being bankrupt. And this was back in like 95. So I got to play everything right beside Jay Burnham, Bill Williams, who are just both fabulous players. And then I went to Eastman, and then I decided, okay, I'm going to take orchestra auditions and I'm going to apply for every job. And whatever happens is whatever's going to happen. And worst case, I'll move back south and I'll freelance in Atlanta and Birmingham, because I knew a lot of the people. We had all played together, and I felt like I was developing a good enough rapport with, you know, John Lawless and Karen Hunt and all those guys from Atlanta and all the Birmingham people, that I'd be able to make it. And so that's what I did. And then I got my first year at Eastman. I didn't get a single call back on any of the college jobs I applied for. And I took a couple of auditions and didn't advance. And then my second year, I got callbacks on everything. And the Kansas thing just happened. That was my first of the interviews, and it was the best of the jobs that I was looking at. And so it just seemed like a good fit. And that was that. The rest is history.
Yeah. how far did you, I mean, I know that you went for piano undergrad. I mean, how originally, so how far along were you in the piano realm?
I sucked. I was a terrible pianist. I was never good. I have a really good memory. Like, I can memorize things quickly, and yeah. I have good ears, so if I hear it, I can memorize it. I can play it.
Yeah.
And my teachers never really told me how to – they never taught me to read well. Mm-hmm. So my first piano teacher, all the students won all the awards because we played the lights out when we showed up for competitions. But if you put hot cross buns in front of us, we couldn't read it. Mm-hmm. And so, and you know, another irony is that she used to stand behind me with an empty 3-ring notebook and a wooden spoon and beat on it to make me play in time, which is, you know, that's pretty funny now, right?
Yeah, right, yeah.
Because that's what I do.
Of course, yeah. That's percussion pedagogy 101 right there.
Right. That's you know, that's good teaching.
Yeah.
So anyway, I never was a good reader. And so I got to Furman and, you know, I show up for my first lesson and I don't have anything prepared because I'm an idiot. And the next week he says, okay, I want you to come back with all these things. And I'm like, holy cow, I can't ingest all of this stuff. I mean, it was like eating a cactus or something. It's like, I just didn't have the mouth for it, you know? Meanwhile, first studio class with the pianists, you know, we're getting in there and people are bringing in entire Brahms sonatas and Chopin and Rachmaninoff, yeah. Like, you know, normal stuff you're supposed to be playing. And I'm like, how long have you been working on that? A week. How much are you practicing? 9 hours a day. Oh, how much are you practicing? I haven't practiced in like 2 or 3 days because I've been out, you know, practicing with the drum line.
Right. Yeah.
You
know? Yeah.
And it just became more and more clear to everybody that really where I wanted to be was playing drums. And then I got really serious after my sophomore year. And that's when I really started catching up to where everybody else was and then trying to get in the fast lane.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's important, too. Like, everywhere I went, every school, I was the worst person there when I got there. You know, when I got to Northwestern, I was definitely the worst player there, even though I was a graduate student. I mean, Angie Zader was a freshman when I was there. Meredith Nelson, Mark Dennett. I mean, all these just incredible players that were there as undergraduates just smoked me. Brian Resnick, Matt Gold. I mean, all these killers. Mm-hmm. They're way better than I was. But, I, you know, instead of getting all like, oh, my God, I'm terrible, I just started figuring out what it was that they had that I didn't and tried to get as much of it as I could. And so I was super motivated to improve by all means and any means necessary. And it was like that at Eastman, too. I've always felt like the class idiot, you know, in every class, and I felt so far behind the undergraduates. And I was a doctoral student at that point with like 3 years of college teaching and professional playing and everything. It still felt like an idiot. I still feel like an idiot all the time. But I mean, you know, it's kind of funny, you know, you talk to guests about these kinds of things and, you know, they're like, oh, you know, you think somebody like Mike Burritt was always like Mike Burritt. Mike Burritt was always not like Mike Burritt. I mean, every artist, I think, has these feelings at some point, whether they choose to admit it or not, that, you know, at some point they were super motivated by the people that are around them. And I think, you know, you can look at it one of two ways. You can either get depressed about it or you can get to work. And, you know, for me, it was just I had a lot of work to do. And so once I figured that out, like around my sophomore year, then it was off to the races. And it was like, you know, I dare you to tell me that I'm not going to be able to do this. And, you know, here we are.
And you knew that you were good at figuring out the path, like you started, you have a real nose for that, it seems like.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that I have that a lot of my friends have too is that naturally we learn how to do stuff and then our first instinct is to share it with people, you know. And it's not just like, okay, this is what works for me when I play Kiji, I want to teach you how to do it. This is how my job path worked for me, or this is the way that I think, or this is the way that I set up my resume, or this is the way, and this works. So this is what I want you to try. You know, I think all of us that do these kinds of things, like that's what your podcast is. It's like, hey, let's bring all these people in to talk about these things so we can share it with others so that they can benefit or try. And if it works, great. If it doesn't, that's okay too. But that's just being a natural teacher. I mean, the whole idea is to get information, process it, master it, and then get it out there for other people. That's the whole idea. It's not to keep it for yourself, like some kind of secret.
Right.
You know, ooh, you know, I'm not going to tell anybody how I got this job. You know, I'm not going to tell anybody how I play Scheherazade. Mm-hmm. It's fucking Scheherazade. It's been that way since 1888. You know, yeah, there are little tricks, and you can spend a whole lifetime working on it. But you know, I mean, you can figure that out. Like, yeah, you don't need, you know, you don't need to keep it to yourself. You can figure it out.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I don't know. At any rate, yeah, I'm still an idiot.
When you get to high school, what was the percussion experience for you at that point?
Well, I didn't have any formal training. I didn't really know anything about it except that I had played trumpet in junior high band. Mm-hmm. And my, like I said, I think we talked about this last time, my parents weren't really hip to me playing drums at all. And so high school for us was 10 through 12.
Yeah.
And I remember going to my first pep rally in 10th grade, and the drum line was playing, and the cheerleaders were dancing, and we're all coming into the gym, and I was like, that is the coolest thing I've ever heard. Now, granted, this is like 1987. Mm-hmm. Drums on slings, mm-hmm. Plastic heads,
yep.
You know, it's very not like what we have now.
Yeah.
But it was still super hip, and I just remember watching them and thinking, I could do that.
Mm-hmm.
I totally could learn how to do that.
Yeah.
So without asking my parents, I went and talked to the band director, and I just went by one afternoon and I said, this is like at the end of my 10th grade year.
Yeah.
And said, I want to learn how to do that. I think I can learn how to do that. And he said, okay. And so he got a guy to kind of teach me how to play tenors. But at the time they had like three snare drums and three bass drums that were not tuned gradually. And the tenors were set up so that it was like a drum set. It was actually like 4-1-2-3 from left to right, instead mm-hmm. of, you know, like one being, you know, right, left, you know, 1-2-3-4, no yep. Spock drums or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured it out. You know, I was a pianist. I could figure out which drum to hit. I only had to deal with four lines. It didn't right. seem like such a big deal, but I didn't know how to roll. I didn't know anything about ornaments or anything like that. And everything was by rote, and they played the same halftime show every year.
Oh,
so
okay.
It was basically, I mean, I don't think we actually learned new tunes, except the band, it was a dance band. And so at the end of the show, we would do some dance tune, like a, you know, whatever. And the whole band would do this kind of almost like Florida A&M kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I know it was really fun, actually.
Yeah, of course.
So I didn't really know what I was doing, but I learned how to do it. And that was kind of my experience. And then I got into the jazz ensemble, but the jazz ensemble had three drum set players who all played at the same time. It was like Snarky Puppy, but uh-huh. not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know? And so I kind of learned how to play basic drum set from those guys mm-hmm. and, you know, from watching MTV and stuff like that. And so I had no formal training at all. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know what the setup was. And then I got to college and, you know, I'm there for drumline auditions, you know, as a freshman, and I didn't even know how to put on a snare drum harness. Like mm-hmm. I had never put on like a, you know, a regular harness. I'd never seen a Kevlar head before. I'd
yeah,
never
yeah.
seen anything like that. And so it was kind of a big wake up call, but I'm a quick learner.
Yeah.
So I figured it out.
Well, and the good news, and I've done work with sling drumming, like not too long ago, as I used to teach at a historically black college, is it's a skill to hold that drum. That's a different
yeah.
set to even do that.
It was super cool. I mean, it and still to this day, like, I have an incredible amount of respect for that entire style and lineage of playing in bands. It's just incredible. And it's electrifying.
Yeah.
You know, to watch. It's super fun.
Yeah.
So anyway, I wasn't particularly good at it.
Yeah. But, so, and then when you put you're like, this is just okay. Just this. That's all I have to do.
That's all I have to do. I don't have to dance. I don't have to do anything. But unfortunately, I did have to do flam drags and other kinds of things that I had no idea how to do. And so I had to learn pretty quickly.
Sure, yeah.
But when I was at Furman, my our section leader my freshman year was the last snare drummer cut off the 88 Blue Devils line.
Mm.
So he was like number 11 of 10.
Yeah.
And so he could play.
Mm-hmm.
I remember sitting down with him for hours and hours and hours for days and weeks, just like going through warm-ups and technique
yep.
and trying to teach me how to move my hands. And I'll never forget that. His name was Lee Haynes. He was an accountant and ended up, you know, he wasn't a music major. He just did all of that stuff for fun.
Yeah.
And I learned a lot from him and several of the other upperclassmen that were pretty amazing.
And how do you end up going to Furman?
I visited the campus and fell in love with the place. I mean, I think that's what happens with most people when they visit that school.
Right.
I mean, it's one of the most beautiful places on the planet.
Yeah, Greenville's amazing.
Especially is now. When you know, we're talking about, what is that, 89? Mm-hmm. Greenville was not the Greenville that it is now, but sure. Furman was still the Furman. I mean, it was still gorgeous, and the faculty were so amazing, and the academic reputation of the school was so fabulous. And I was kind of unfocused. I mean, I really hadn't applied for like music schools. I mean, I'd applied for like Chapel Hill mm-hmm. and UGA. My mom went to UGA. My uncle went to UGA. And so I'd applied there, but I didn't apply for music. I didn't apply for music at Chapel Hill. And I applied at Davidson because my father had gone there. Again, not for music. And I think I had applied maybe at Appalachian. Mm-hmm. Again, not for music. And Furman was like the only place, and I went and, you know, met the piano faculty, and they seemed really interested, and I don't know, they just kind of took me under their wing, and I felt like that school was mostly interested in me, even though they had no reason to be. I mean, I wasn't a particularly good pianist or anything. So I don't know, it just felt like it felt like a family kind of place right off the bat, and as it turns out, that's exactly what I needed. I mean, I never, never, ever would have been able to do what I'm doing if it hadn't been for Furman. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt. No doubt. I mean, I wouldn't have lasted 5 seconds in my own program mm-hmm. here. I mean, I wouldn't have even been able to visit.
Sure, yeah.
You know? I mean, and I would have been swallowed alive by any of these other schools just as a general population student that had no idea what he was doing. I mean, I never would have made it. I would have failed out of any of those schools. And anyone who knows me, who knew me back then when I was a freshman, sophomore, and junior in college – was probably, if they listen to this, they're going to laugh and shake their head and be like, yeah, that dude would have been in jail, because that's exactly where I would have been if I hadn't gone to Furman. Mm-hmm. So it was a real blessing that I was able to go there and kind of bounce around like a pinball until I found what it was that I wanted to do. And once I figured that out, then it was pretty much, you know, straight path.
Because I want to ask you about what's it like to be at a high performing, not just because it's not you don't, because those students that are there are like the cream of the crop of the top level in every field. And so what's it like to be in that environment, and not just including not just the music stuff, but like just overall?
You know, it's humbling when you go to, I mean, I'm typically, as we laughed about last time, I don't go to a whole lot of meetings, but when I do meet people, you know, from like the physics department or math or, you know, whatever it happens to be. I mean, the stuff that people are working on here is just incredible. I mean, that's true for most of your guests that are at any level of university. I mean, colleagues that you have across campus, we don't have the chance to meet with them that often. But when you do, it's really amazing to see just how much they're changing the world.
Yeah.
And that to me is like super exciting from a collaborative standpoint, but also just from a humility standpoint, that, you know, what people are doing here really is changing the world in a lot of ways. And it's beyond, you know, playing clean four-stroke roughs, you know, mm-hmm. not that that's not important, because it is super important, but it's not, you know, it's nice to get out and be around colleagues who are really doing things that impact our world.
Yeah.
So, although I love it.
Yeah. Although if they could maybe try, you know, once in a while, try to play the drum part for Shake Your Body Down to the Ground by the Jacksons, you know, just once, just give it a shot.
I'm not saying that they shouldn't. But, you know, when you're busy trying to cure cancer, you know, I get it. But, you know, the interesting thing is that more people, I'm sure you've run into this too at Mizzou. It's like you meet people from the medical school or you meet people from other colleges, and you realize that a lot of them do actually go to concerts, and they do mm-hmm. come see, you know, College of Music things, and they do know the faculty, and they do have their kids involved. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't tell you how many people I've met in the community just in the last several months who are all either actively involved in the University Musical Associates, which is kind of like our booster club for the College of Music, or they have their children involved, or they know faculty members, or they play music themselves in some kind of amateur fashion. I mean, Tallahassee's a pretty artistically rich place. And so being a part of the College of Music is kind of neat, because you go out in the community and say that you teach at FSU. Oh, that's great. What do you do? I'm in the College of Music. Oh, wow. You know, it's not like that everywhere.
Yeah.
And it wasn't necessarily like that when I was at, you know, my other jobs, to have that kind of respect for the school, because people will say, oh my gosh, you know, the College of Music, that's like a crown jewel for FSU. And that's true. You know, and so it's really kind of cool to be a part of that and to try and contribute as much as I can.
Sure. So how do you end up falling into the percussion side of things at Furman?
As far as like how did it happen?
Yeah, in terms of you finishing out there the way you did.
Well, I started off in the drum line, and there weren't a whole lot of us in the percussion program when I was there. There were maybe like five of us. And I wasn't even a major. I was a music ed major, but I was piano, believe it or not. Like, I didn't know how that was going to work. But again, I didn't really know what I was doing. But I was taking percussion lessons. But I was playing in marching band, wind ensemble, jazz ensemble, percussion ensemble, and orchestra. And all of those have their separate funny stories of what those were like at the very beginning. But, you know, I was doing all those and taking lessons, like 30-minute lessons a week, where I was just learning basic technique and like how to hold mallets and all that kind of stuff. And it became increasingly clear to my piano teacher when I would show up week after week unprepared for any kind of piano lesson that I was obviously gravitating more and more towards percussion. And that became more clear to my teacher too, John Beckford. And so eventually, after, you know, kind of dancing around it for like a year and a half, we just said, okay, let's just call this piano thing off and let's just go full bore with percussion and music ed. So then it was, okay, I'm going to be a high school band director. That's really what I want to do. And then that morphed into, okay, that's not what I want to do. I want to be a professional orchestra player and or college teacher, or college teacher and or professional orchestra player, or, you know, some combination, however it works out. And that's kind of the path that I was on for, I'm still on. That's still what I do.
Sure. When you do make the switch, I know that you said you're kind of getting, this is your first chance of doing lessons in any real sense. Are you, how far along are you, or do you basically have to, do they just start you over, or have you made some progress once you've made the switch fully?
It's hard to say. Like, I don't really remember much. I mean, Beckford's retiring in April of this year. This is his last year teaching at Furman. And I'd have to ask him. Like, I'm sure he's got some funny stories. He probably remembers it a lot better than I did, because some of those years are pretty much a haze for me. For a variety of reasons, I don't really remember very much of what was happening in lessons, except the takeaway was that what I learned from him was more about how to be an amazing, like, at least how to be a professional. You know, I don't always do it, and I'm not always the best example, but I know what a true professional is, and I know what a true mentor is, and I know what it means to care about your students, about their well-being, and to be in touch with them their whole lives, and the kind of impact that you can have on them. I learned all of that from him. And it was way beyond, you know, how do I play a better multiple bounce role, or how do I play this excerpt, or how do I hold these mallets, or how do I interpret Merlin, or, you know, whatever it is. That was never what our lessons were really about. It was more like life through percussion rather than percussion is your life. And it had to be that way because Furman is such an intense place, because there's so few of you and you're expected to do everything at such a high level, and academically too, like, because it's liberal arts. You're not just doing music. I mean, you're out taking cultural history of Japan and social problems and psychology and, you know, all these things that my students don't have to take. And they expect you to make A's and all of that stuff too.
Yeah.
You know? And so, I mean, it was insane. I mean, the pressure was pretty crazy. So when I got to grad school, you know, people were talking about how much, you know, they don't have any time to practice and stuff. I'm like, oh my God, I've got nothing but time.
Yeah.
Cause I'm not, you know, cause I'm not studying Krebs cycles and right. You know, other stuff, you know, this is, you know, I can actually practice. This is great. But, anyway, so yeah, I don't know where I was. I mean, grad school is where everything really took off for me, but I think what Furman really provided was a super solid technical foundation that I could then build on, you know, kind of a grammar foundation for me to build on as a musician later on. But, and that's what Beckford, I think, did the best.
Yeah. So you get, that's a music ed degree.
Uh-huh.
And you student taught, I assume.
I did.
Now, at what point did you realize that it wasn't the band directing that you didn't want to do?
Student teaching.
Okay.
That pretty much did it. I had taught drum lines in the summers leading up to that and loved it.
Yeah.
But I kind of learned quickly that I'm good at swooping in and swooping out. You know, I think that dealing with teaching different age levels, they're gifts of different kinds. Like teaching elementary kids is a gift. I mean, teaching period is a gift, but you have to have a very special gift to teach elementary kids. You have to have a special one for junior high. You have to have a special one for high school, a special one for college, a special for grad school, a special for, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I realized quickly that I love teaching and I think that I'm good at it, but I'm not good at working with students that are not 110% fully invested and committed to making music the central part of their artistic existence.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not the case for most high school students, even in places like Texas or D.C. or Florida or Ohio that have these massive, you know, music programs and super arts intensive programs. Not every kid in those programs is going to make that the center of their lives. And I just found that it was hard for me to relate to people that didn't have that. And so it made it difficult for me. And I also take everything super personally, which I know I shouldn't.
Yeah,
but I do, and so it was really hard for me not to get the fact that I would do anything to get them to do something, and then when they wouldn't meet me even halfway because of their lives, it was hard for me to understand. And so I just found that, okay, I need to not do this because I think I'm going to ruin lives if I have to teach high school. So if I had had to do it, if I had been faced with, I can't win an orchestra job, I'll never get a college teaching job, and freelancing isn't going to work out for whatever reason, I probably would have sold insurance or something, because I had the self-realization early on that I would do more damage as a high school teacher than I would good. So I knew that even as much as I love music, that I probably should have done something else if it came down to that, just because that's a gift I don't have. And I have so much respect for the people that do have it. I mean, the Midas touch teachers that can go in and do stuff that at that level and at all those levels. I mean, it's just mind boggling when I watch people like, you know, Cliff Walker, and I watch people like Adam Wynkin. And I mean, there's so many just amazing people out there that are doing incredible jobs at that level. I'm not one of them. I mean, I can come in and clean your group and, you know, for 2 or 3 days and hopefully not, you know, scar your students for life in the process. And I can do that, but I can't live with them forever. It's just not, I'm not able to do it.
Do you put that on your, do you put that on your card or on your,
no,
I may or may not scar your students for life.
No, I mean, I think people know, I mean, you know, Dan McGuire and Adam and, you know, all those guys, they know what they're getting if they have me come out. But yeah. I think the result, hopefully, is worth the trauma, you know, I guess. I suppose.
Again, you just got to market that. I feel like you can make that.
Maybe that should be the thing, you know, the results are worth the trauma.
Yeah.
I suppose.
John W. Parks the IV. The results are worth the trauma. Yeah.
Perhaps. Actually, I kind of like the ring of that.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah, we'll just say that it came from here, and we can co-market that together if you want.
We'll trademark it. I like it.
Yeah, we'll do it. When you're finished with your undergrad, and are you already thinking I'm definitely continuing on as a percussionist at that point? You knew that you wanted to get it go into percussion specifically, like like the focus.
Okay. Absolutely.
So, and you did your master's where?
At Northwestern.
Okay. So how do you, at that point, how do you know about Northwestern?
Well, I actually knew because of the band world. I knew because of John Painter, who had been, you know, kind of put up on this huge pedestal by our director of bands when I was an undergraduate. And of course, Northwestern has this incredibly rich history with wind band and performance in general.
Right.
Orchestrally and with all of the CSO faculty and everything else. And so I'd initially become interested in the school just because of Painter and because of the reputation of the university and the music school in general, but also because Patsy Dash taught there. And I was really interested in studying with her. She won the job in '86 with CSO. And so it was still pretty new. And so I felt like, you know, that would be a really good match. And I'd been to visit the school as a junior and got to spend some time with her walking around, and she just seemed really cool, and we hit it off. And so it just seemed like a good match. But it's interesting, like all the schools that I looked at, none of them were like in the same vein. Like I was looking at, I applied to James Madison because I wanted to work with the drumline and, cause I loved Bill Rice so much and who still is one of my dear friends. And that's a funny story when I auditioned there, but we won't get into it. But I love Bill. Tony Falcone was also teaching there, who I love. Mm-hmm. And he's now at Nebraska with Carolyn Barber and Dave Hall and those guys.
Yep.
And I looked at South Florida, actually. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of interesting because our director of bands had been to South Florida and knew Bob McCormick really well. And this was especially when, you know, Bob was just recording CDs constantly with his wife. And I had a whole bunch of them. And, you know, that studio had this reputation for being really super cutting edge. And so I was really interested in that program. And then I auditioned at Michigan. And then, but the funny thing about Michigan is that my GPA wasn't high enough for me to actually be accepted into the university.
Mm.
So I ended up not being able to get in because I didn't have a 3.0.
Yeah.
And that pissed me off.
I'm sure it did.
I was mad. So I didn't even get a chance to like get accepted to Michigan. But anyway, so I ended up going to Northwestern, which was perfect. I was the first drumline TA they had ever had. They basically developed that assistantship for me to have. And which is still going strong after all of these years. And so I got to be the first guy to work with the marching band as a graduate assistant. And it was so fun. Like, the definitely two of the best years of my life there. And at the time they had, I think we talked about this last time, so I won't rehash it, but the master's degree was 1 year. Mm. And so you went in and you would do 1 year, and it was very much a, you know, you're terrible, you're terrible, you're terrible, here's your degree, and you're out.
Great.
And I was actually staying to do a performer certificate the second year, but then all the stuff happened with Applebaum getting the job at UMKC, and then they had the job search where Mike came in during my second year, and Ed Harrison was coming in to teach during the interim, and I actually wasn't going to stay in school after the fall because a lot of the studio members left and transferred to Juilliard and other places, and I already had one master's degree, so I was just going to take doctoral auditions. So I auditioned at Michigan and at Northwestern, at Michigan and Eastman, and then I got the Sanford job all like within 2 weeks of each other. So I was like, well, okay, I'm going to take the job. And UDAL was doing Santa Fe Opera at the time in the summers, and so they didn't have very much of a summer program. And Eastman, of course, has a robust summer program. And so it just worked out that I was going to be able to work and then go to Eastman in the summers and then do residency down the road and be able to get the degree from there. And JB and I had hit it off. But I loved UDAL too, and I loved Ann Arbor. I mean, I think either place would have been fabulous. I think my career would have gone in a different direction had I gone to Ann Arbor. But it would have been interesting to see too. I mean, I have a lot of respect for both programs, obviously.
The 2 years that you're at Northwestern, I mean, that's an enormous amount of change for the program in 2 years. I mean, like,
oh, yeah.
Were you just like, what, who am I, wait, what, you're here, and then you're – so I mean, what was just the kind of vibe then?
Well, you know, the thing that I love the most is that the level of player there was so high. Angie Zader-Nelson was a freshman mm-hmm. when I was a first year master student. Forgive me if we talked about this last time because I can't okay. remember, but she was, I mean, holy crap. I mean, just nails. I mean, she came in, she had a piano scholarship too. I mean, she was just a freakishly talented musician and such a cool person too. She was there. Brian Resnick, who ended up playing Rent for a long time on Broadway. He was a winner of the Schulte Project when that was happening. He ended up going to Juilliard. Fabulous musician. Actually gave me my first cymbal lesson, and he was a sophomore, and I was a master's student. Matt Gold, who's now a freelancer in New York, played on Broadway for a long time and plays with Alarm Will Sound. I mean, again, just one of the most incredible musicians that I had ever met to that point, and still to this day have an enormous amount of respect for. Meredith Nelson, who was in the Marine Band. Mark Dennitz, who's still in the Air Force Band. I mean, I can go on and on and on. I mean, these were the people that I was surrounded by all the time. And so, in a way, the rest didn't matter. Like, I was with these people all the time and learned so much from them, just like an amoeba. Like, I would just get, like, try to be as – to suck as much out of them as I could, you know, or to absorb as much from them as I could from every rehearsal and every studio class and every time that I'd see them sitting out in the hall with a practice pad and they'd be working on something. I'd say, what are you doing? Show me. Why do your rolls sound like that and mine don't? Why do your cymbal crashes sound like that and mine don't? Why do your tambourine rolls sound like that and mine don't? You know, and so that was like the groundwork. And then working with Patsy was like the icing, you know, because I was working on all that stuff downstairs. And then when I would go upstairs to see her, that was when she would put, you know, sprinkle the fairy dust on it. And that's what I loved about being there. Plus working with Painter and Victor and all these other amazing people, Steve Peterson, Don Owens, who ran the jazz program that I eventually ended up getting a degree from. I mean, it was just an amazing time to be there. Knowing what I know now, I would still go back and have the exact same things happen, just because it was so formative for me.
Because when we talked last time, and you were talking about how you were, you know, you didn't know that there was a hurricane.
Oh yeah.
That like you could have. It sounds like you had already developed an ability to like just. My zone is here, and I know that there's all this other stuff going on, but here's where my focus is, and everyone around me is.
Oh yeah, it was like my focus was Regenstein and Pick Stager and Orchestra Hall with the Symphony Center now, but that was it.
Yeah,
like everything that I did revolved around, and the marching band in the fall. Everything revolved around that. And all I cared about was hanging out and going to Norris to get coffee and ice cream and sitting around with these guys and picking their brains about literature and teachers. And I mean, God, I mean, you know what it's like when you go to school with all these people? That's like the best part of school. I mean, yeah. The practicing, yes. The lessons, yes. The concerts, mm-hmm. All that stuff. But it's hanging out with your colleagues, especially the graduate students that come from these other programs, and learning as much as you can from them about what makes them tick.
Yeah.
That, to me, is like that's what makes school so exciting. It's the cross-pollination of all of the different experiences of all the different people that are in that family. And I think that's why it's so important to me now to have that here, is because that was so important to me, because I was the outsider. I didn't know shit when I went in, you know, comparatively. So, I mean, it was pretty awesome. I mean, I loved that experience.
Yeah. I just think of when I was an undergrad, that my favorite – a part of, you know, of when I'd go practice was practicing was fine, but like then it would be if one of your friends was over there, and so you just like go into their practice room and just talk for like a half hour, like
break. we would take it up a notch. We would go in and we would call it we called it Coloss for Cash, but we would basically, it was any excerpt, like anybody that was playing anything.
Uh-huh.
You'd hear him playing whatever, Exotic Birds or polka or whatever.
Yeah.
And you just walk in and put a dollar bill down on the instrument and take the mallets, and whoever played it best took the dollars. Mm. I mean, we had all kinds of fun games, you know, to do those kinds of things. So, yeah, there was still a lot of business that was going on. But, God, man, just being around people that could play like that. And the same thing was true at Eastman. I mean,
oh, of course.
Again, I was the dumbest person and the worst player, and I got so much out of all the people that were around me. It was just – that was as much of an education as any other aspect of being there.
Yeah. Did you find when you go from a place like Furman where it's small and you're spread out all over the place to, you know, when you're in this way more focused environment with like the level of playing is higher. Did you find yourself like, are you someone who like you would see that was like, that's the level and you're like, all right, I know. That's where I got to get to, like immediately. Are you someone like, is that kind of how it rolls for you mentally?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I was like, okay, now I see what I need to do. In fact, I see beyond what I need to do and look out. Mm-hmm. I'm a man obsessed mm-hmm. with, you know, getting better. And especially in those days, man, it was just like, I knew where my liabilities were. I knew what I needed to do. Of course, I didn't know that until I saw it.
Sure.
And then once I saw it and I heard it, I was like, I've got to figure that out and make that part of my, you know, bag of tricks, and so to speak. And so that was it. And for me, it was always, you know, I love orchestral playing. I love solo playing. But I never really felt that way about, like, world percussion or, you know, pans or, you know, so many of the other things that we get into that we're exposed to now more than ever. I mean, Northwestern didn't have – I mean, there was no hand drumming going on with any of us.
Yeah.
You know, when I was at Eastman, there was no hand drumming that was really going on. I'm trying to think of anybody that was there when I was there that was into anything that was outside of the norm. Like, you know, like a standard, like, conservatory kind of thing, except Blake Tyson is an excellent Darabuka player, and Peyton McDonald is an excellent tabla player, and he's into a whole bunch of other stuff. And Steve Owen was an incredible drum set player. He's with the Marine Band now. But everybody else, I mean, I don't remember any of them being like super into anything other than chamber playing, excerpt playing, and solo playing. I mean, I just don't, maybe I'm misremembering it, but there just wasn't anybody in the studio like a Megan Ahrens who's like, oh, I've been to Ghana. I've been to, you know, all these different things. I'm into all of these things, to bring that into a studio environment. We just didn't have anybody like that. And so that's kind of exciting too, because, you know, those are still things that I don't really know anything about. And so it's really nice when I have a student like her, although now obviously she's a colleague, but when she came in, I mean, she was so helpful because she knew a ton of stuff that I didn't know. So I could help her with, okay, let's figure out your four-stroke roughs, and let's figure out how to play Porgy like a professional, and you can turn around and help me with, you know, these rhythms, and you can help me with, you know, making sure that methods class, these kids get some of this stuff that they're not going to get from me because I don't know anything about it, and I don't have time to know anything about it. And quite frankly, it doesn't light me up the way that it does you, so I don't want to know anything about it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, I understand that calculus is important, but that doesn't mean that I want to go learn how to do it.
Right.
And that's kind of how it is. A lot of the world stuff, like, I think it's super cool, and I really love listening to it, and I love watching it and listening to it, but it just doesn't really do anything. It doesn't move me the way that Mahler does, or the way that Shostakovich does, or the way that Debussy does. It just doesn't, it's not the same for me.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you know, and I'm relating it back to Florida State. I'm going to use the word pressure as this, but did you feel pressure at Florida State, and, you know, to make sure that you, that some of these other tracks, or did you not even worry about that, other, these other like world tracks or these other parts of percussion that were not necessarily your specialty, were parts of the program?
Yes and no. Our ethnomusicology program is really strong here. I think actually we've got one of your recent alums.
Yeah,
in
Abby.
I just met her a few weeks ago.
Yeah, she's awesome.
They take, like, they've got, you know, the salsa band, they've got the Afro-Cuban ensemble, they've got all the steel stuff. All that stuff happens over there.
Yeah.
So when students come to me and they say, I want to play in gamelan, or I want to learn how to play congas, or I want to learn how to play this, I say, go talk to the ethnomusicology people, get in one of those ensembles and go figure it out. So then I don't have to pretend to be an expert in something, you know. And of course, the other thing that's changed so much, Pete, is that they can just look on the computer, man. Look any of that stuff up on YouTube. Go to like the Vic Firth website. You can find just about anything you'd ever want there on anything.
Yeah.
And just learn it. I mean, just it's the same way that I learned how to audio record.
Yeah.
Or do video. I mean, you just get on the computer and go figure it out. And so now it's like, well, I need to learn how to play. I don't know, name your thing, like a really good wiro pattern. Mm-hmm. You know, how do I play that? Well, go get on the computer, go grab one, and go figure it out. I mean, I'm not the guy that can show you how to do that.
Yeah.
You know, you can go do that yourself. So I'm not a crotchety old man, but I know what I know, and I know how to get it across to you, and I know what I don't know, and I know where to send you to figure it out.
Yeah.
So
you aspire to be a crotchety old man.
Yeah, I see myself becoming one day, but it's not there. I'm not there yet.
Yeah, but you see the path, just like your degrees. You see where you can get to.
The path, I see it in front of me, but I may not take it. I mean, I can see it easily going off to one side, but I've never been crotchety. It's just that I know what I know, and I think people that are interested in doing that. One of the reasons that when you go to the website for the FSU Percussion Studio, that you see where the alums are right off the bat, and you see the kinds of things that they're doing. There's several reasons for that. One is that if you want to do those kinds of things, then hopefully you know what you're going to get if you decide to come here. Right. So if you're really like super into ethno, or, you know, I shouldn't say that because then you would go through ethnomusicology. But let's say that you're like a jazz vibraphone player and you want to go somewhere where you can really do that. This is not your place.
Right.
You know, but if you want to come in somewhere where you can learn to, or where you have a really great shot at getting a college job or you want to win a military band job, or you want to get placed in a high-end conservatory like NEC or Manhattan or Eastman or whatever else that will then allow you to be in a position where you could win a performing job, you know, with one of these military bands or with a professional orchestra. I mean, we just had one of our alums win the section with Virginia Symphony, like a month ago, I think. If you're interested in that, then you know what you're getting if you get in here and you decide to come. So we put those things up there so people understand this is what we do. This is what I do. Mm-hmm. I don't do these other things. I'm not the person that can teach you how to play bongos. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't, you know.
Got it.
And I'm not going to learn how to do it between now and the time that you get here. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just not my thing. And, you know, people out there might be like, how can you say that? You're a professor of percussion at one of the top music schools in the country. How can you not play bongos? It's easy. I can't do it.
Well, you don't need to.
I don't need to. And the people that come here to study with me either already know how to play bongos or will figure it out from YouTube, and they don't come here to learn how to play bongos from me. Mm-hmm. And you could say, well, maybe you should learn how to play bongo so you can teach it. Well, the thing is, if I do that, that's taking time away from me figuring out the next best ways to teach all these other things that I do teach
right.
at a high level. And I'm not willing to I'm not looking to dilute that teaching by doing something that I know that they can figure out themselves another way or seek out another teacher to teach them how to do it themselves.
Right.
So that's just kind of me. That's my crotchetiness, but I'm not really crotchety.
Mm-hmm. But again, you see where the path goes for the.
I can see it, but I don't have to go that way. Right. I can just say, look, man, I'm not a bongo player.
Yeah,
right. You know,
I have other ways of being crotchety. Is what I'm saying.
I have plenty of ways of being crotchety.
But I'm curious, like when you got to Florida State, how big was the ethno part of Florida State? Was it already an established thing too?
Yeah, it's okay. Big. Faculty here, terrific. Michael Bakken is a world-renowned expert ethnomusicologist. I mean, his textbook is like the Bible for a lot of musicology programs. At the time, Dale Olson was here. I mean, we have a lot of pretty amazing people. There are like 15 world music ensembles. Mm. I mean, it's a big deal. I mean, Abby obviously would be able to tell you a lot more about it. This place is so big, Pete, that I don't even see these people for like eons.
Right.
I mean, I'll see Bakken like maybe once a year, mm-hmm. maybe on a committee.
Yeah.
And that's about it. But I know that they have a ton of stuff that's going on over there mm-hmm. just because I hear about it all the time. But, you know, that's one of the crown jewels within the College of Music for sure.
Just tell me again about how you get to your first job, but also are doing a doctoral part at the same time.
Okay. So I got into Eastman and mm-hmm. into Michigan, and then I got this job. So I took the job, and because Michigan didn't have a summer program, that was that.
Okay.
And accepted the position at Eastman. So I started teaching in fall of 1995 at Samford in mm-hmm. Birmingham, and then started my doctorate in the summer of 96.
Okay.
So I taught at Samford for 3 years. And did summers for the 3 summers after that, and then took a leave of absence from Samford for a year to do my residency at Eastman.
Okay.
And during that year, or during those 3 years, I was playing with Alabama Symphony as the second percussionist, basically, as they came back from bankruptcy, which was amazing. So then I'm at Eastman for the year, and I determined after about, I don't know, maybe the first semester, that I didn't want to go back to the job. Because it wasn't that I didn't like it. I did actually like it. But I was directing the marching band and the basketball band, teaching jazz fundamentals, running the jazz band, teaching music appreciation, aural skills, percussion ensemble. Yeah, I mean, it was insane. I mean, it was totally insane.
Yeah.
And as much as I loved it, I realized, okay, I think what I really want to do is have something that's a little bit more streamlined to my specialties or to the things that I would like to make my specialties. Mm-hmm. So I decided not to come back and stayed for another year at Eastman for another year of residency. And then I got the Kansas job. And so then I moved to KU and was there for 3 years. And then I got the FSU job, and then I've been here since then.
When did you finish – your doctorate before you got to KU?
No. I had to take the comprehensive exams while I was at Kansas. So I studied for about 10 months Yeah, it was insane. Well, I tried to take them like three times, but I just, when it came right down to taking the test, I chickened out because I felt like I was so stupid. And I still felt stupid when I took them. I studied for 10 months. Mm-hmm. I mean, you should have seen my house. I mean, it literally, the entire, it looked like a tornado had gone through a library. I mean, I had books and scores, CDs everywhere in the bathroom, in the kitchen, mm-hmm. scores everywhere. I mean, for months and months and months and months. I mean, I would go out with my friends and draw crap cannons on cocktail napkins. I mean, it was insane. But anyway, I took the exams the summer of 2001 after my first year at Kansas and passed the writtens and then passed the orals, and then I was done.
Nice.
So, yeah, 2001.
Got it. What did you find similar or different between Northwestern and Eastman?
Similarities, the expectations and level of player, definitely in line. I found a lot of the ensemble experiences. It's hard for me to remember exactly because Northwestern at the time, you know, playing in Painter's Wind Group and playing in Yampolsky's Orchestra, those were the best groups I'd ever played in. By far. I mean, definitely the highest level that I had ever played in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember one of my favorite John Painter stories. My first rehearsal with SWE is what they called it, the Symphonic Wind Ensemble.
Yep.
We were doing the Hindemith Symphony, and I was playing timpani. So we get in there, Painter comes in, sits down in his chair, and starts it off. You know, and the clarinets are doing their thing. And we get like 30 seconds in, and I've told this story before, but it's still such a good one. And he stops, and he says, "Clarinets, let me hear you." And he lets them do their thing. You know, that's total chaos in that spot. And he just puts his baton down on the stand, and he says, "It's time to ask yourselves a question. Am I really good enough to be here?" And he looks around at everybody, and he says, "Ensemble, you're dismissed. Clarinets, stay." Everybody leaves.
Oh, my God.
We come back next rehearsal. It's a whole new clarinet section.
Oh.
I was like, "Welcome to Northwestern."
Yeah. Okay.
I better get my shit together because yeah. I'm not going to be able to let things slide here, you know?
Message received, sir.
Message received, sir. Exactly. 10-4. Yeah. Roger.
Yeah.
So that was like a big wake-up call for me. And then when I was in Alabama, you know, getting to play with Alabama, that was like the first real full-time professional orchestra that I had ever gotten to play with. Mm. And the timpanist, Jay Burnham, had, you know, won the Cleveland job prior to that. And, I mean, these players were no joke. I mean, that's where Tom Freer played before he went to Cleveland. Jim Ross's father had played there. Bill Williams, the principal, is just a fabulous player and became a very close friend and mentor to me. I mean, the players there were terrific.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were playing a, you know, 12 Masterworks season thing. I mean, it was, you know, full seasons of pops and children's concerts and, you know, the whole deal. And so then that, you know, that was a different level because the preparation time is so short, you know, versus what you're doing in school, even at a place like Northwestern or Eastman. I mean, the preparation time that you have for concerts is so much longer than it is when you're in a professional orchestra. But then when I went to Eastman, you know, I was on Hunsberger's last Japan tour with the Eastman Wind Ensemble. And that was by far the best group I had ever played with up until that time, because the way that works there is that when the Eastman Wind Ensemble plays at Midwest or they go on tour or they record, that's not the everyday Eastman Wind Ensemble. That's an auditioned group of the best wind players at Eastman. So the best wind players and percussionists. So that you're hearing like the best people at the school in that ensemble. And I mean, that section was Gwen Deese now,
yeah.
Who teaches Michigan State,
yep.
Nate Bartlett. Lee Vinson was supposed to be in it with us, but he ended up winning the Navy Band audition before he won Boston. And he was supposed to be in it. Donnie Albro was with us, Steve Owen from the Marine Band, and me. I mean, just a killer percussion section.
Yeah.
And I mean, the rest of the group is a bunch of, you know, super high named orchestra people now. I mean, it was just ridiculous. And so we were on tour through Japan and Taiwan and play. Oh, my God, that was just an incredible experience. So I think the things that they had in common, I mean, the performance level, the expected performance level was very similar. But what was different was that the academics that were expected at Eastman, especially from the doctoral students, I mean, that's probably the most intense academic DMA in the country, which, you know, anyone will tell you that's gone through it. It's completely insane.
Yeah.
What you have to be able to do there versus what you have to do at any other school. Yeah. And I mean, I know the people who've gone through doctorates at virtually every other school in this country, and it doesn't even come close. So just to survive it is, you know, a badge of honor, I think.
Right. Well, I was around Megan when she was finishing, when she was trying to get her comps done. And yeah, I had hard comps, and at UNC Greensboro, but I was like, I knew that like that was the, I was telling, because my wife is not a musician, but I was like, this is the hardest thing to do pretty much is getting through the orals at Eastman.
I mean, it's ridiculous. All of them are just ridiculous. I mean, I have never felt so stupid as I did after 10 months of intense study. Like I know that I was as smart as I knew more about music then than I will ever know in my entire life. And I still felt like I didn't know anything. I was scared to death. I was more scared then than I was when I first started studying, if that makes any sense. It's like you become so aware of the fact that you don't know anything.
Yeah.
It's totally scary. So, but I survived it. I got really lucky. I had questions that I had kind of anticipated. I mean, for the last month of studying, all I did, I would wake up every day. I would study 8 hours a day.
Yeah.
And this was after school was out, before the exams. I would wake up, I would study 8 hours, and I would come up with the most insane essay questions that I could possibly think of. Like, if I were the most evil person in the world, what would I come up with? And then I would spend the whole day answering those questions.
Yeah.
And it just so happened that the essay questions that were on the written exam were some of those questions that I came up with that were the most evil questions that I could possibly imagine.
Do you remember one of those? So,
I remember not having to answer one of them. Okay. But I still have my exam because I had to take it remotely. So I had to copy it and send it off before I sent it. But I can remember in my orals having to sit down at the piano and compare McCoy Tyner's voicings to augmented six chords.
Okay.
Now, tell me why a percussionist should have to do that.
Yeah.
Right? I remember those are the kinds of things like that you would have to do. I mean, you know, there were a lot, the orals were pretty intense actually. So, you know, it was not out of line for you to be sitting there for one of them to look at you and say, Frescobaldi, go. All right. So how often do you come in contact with Frescobaldi, Pete, as a percussionist or in your chosen field? What do you know about Frescobaldi?
We do Frescobaldi every day in marching band. I don't know what you're talking about.
But
come on, man.
To be fair, the trick was that, you know, they would always say, you know, if you can just figure out enough, if you can figure out enough about everybody that you can string things together, then you'll survive the experience. But it literally is, they just throw you with no life jacket into the middle of the ocean, and you've got to find something.
Yeah.
And so it was pretty rough, but you know, I'm glad that I survived it.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I don't have to go through it again.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it feels like your first line would be, Frescobaldi's trash. Let's talk about Hummel. You know, something like that.
Like, can we talk about something else? I choose not to answer that.
Right, yeah, yeah.
I plead the fifth.
Yeah.
I would much rather talk about, you know, how do you tune a snare drum? That's more my speed.
Yeah. And you're like, oh, Donnie Frescobaldi? Oh, I know. Like, that guy's crazy.
Yeah, he failed out last semester. Yeah, yeah. He was in the counterpoint class.
Yeah, yeah. Seems weird you want to bring him up in this, but all right, fine.
But no, I mean, I know that the exams have morphed a little bit. Marie Rolfe is a good friend of mine, and I've been up to Eastman a few times to represent the school as part of this future faculty initiative that the University of Rochester does, which is super fun. And they bring alums from all the different schools at the University of Rochester to come in and mentor young faculty about, you know, getting jobs and keeping jobs and doing that kind of stuff. And I've done it, I think, twice now. And so I get to spend some time with Marie and some of the other administrators there and talk about the exam experience and what's changed and what's the same. And I think now it's a little less open season on literally everything. And it's a little bit more instrument specific, but I think the written still may be completely open season. It's just the orals are a little bit more. But the thing is that there were never really any rules. It was whatever whoever was sitting in that room decided to ask you about is the way the exam went.
Yeah.
So it was really just a matter of luck. If you got people that were going to be cool and wanted to have a discussion with you, it was great. If you had somebody that came in and wanted to go after you, then there was nothing anybody could do.
Right.
So, and that was kind of the scary thing. But my committee was actually pretty cool. I mean, it was like a 2.5 hour discussion.
Yeah.
But the writtens were 2 full days.
Yeah.
I mean, it was nuts.
A slight backtrack, but when you're at Samford, you're doing like, I would almost call like a very typical small school.
Yeah.
Band percussion job. It sounds like, sadly, I mean, even with all the stuff you were doing. So did you, When you have to, because you have to do a residency for a year, right? I mean, like as a requirement.
Right.
So, at that period, where did you think was the that time coming up at Eastman? Were you like, I'm so ready for a break? Like, did you think of it that way, or was it like when you're at Eastman, you're like, oh, I can't go back now.
I loved Samford.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I loved the job. Yeah. I mean, I had never run a marching band before.
Mm-hmm.
I had never written drill before. I mean, I was in the interview and they're like, we noticed you didn't send any drill with your application. I was like, that's because I've never written any.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, but I can guarantee you that I will never have to answer that question this way in an interview ever again, you know, ever again. I will take care of this.
Yeah.
And they took a big chance on me. I mean, I was 23, 24 years old, no doctorate.
Mm-hmm.
No experience, no nothing to come in and run a college marching band. I mean, holy crap, who does that?
Yeah.
But they really took a chance on me, and I did my best. I mean, there were 35 kids in that marching band when I got there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, along with the director of bands, we said, all right, we're gonna try and bring in 40 freshmen a year. And so this is back in the days when, I mean, computers were not helpful.
Yeah.
You know?
I know what you mean.
And I mean, I remember having a green printout of like, you know, dot matrix printout that was about this thick of that like folding paper, mm-hmm. with the, you know, the stuff on, like, of every kid who applied to Samford that had been accepted that had put music as part of their interests on the ACT or the SAT, like as part of their application.
Yeah.
And I called them.
Mm-hmm.
To try and get that. I mean, this is what we would do with recruiting. And then I got smart and started getting students to help me do it too. And we would do it in shifts. I mean, it was like a phone-a-thon.
Yeah.
We would call people, and we got that band bigger by wanting people more than everybody else did.
Mm-hmm.
And we built this huge community. We decided that we were going to be like Future Core at Disney. You know, we were going to be smaller, but we were going to play in tune. We were going to play in tone, and we were going to play cleaner and march cleaner than anybody else. And therefore, we were going to be 5 times louder than we should have been.
Right.
And, you know, we had arrangers that knew how to write for our ensemble, and I learned how to write drill for the ensemble, and I loved it. I mean, to feel that kind of pride in a group that you know, are working with that is building itself, you know, in quality, and people noticed, man. I mean, the football team was terrible, so it was like we really were the highlight for a lot of the football games. You know, it was great. So I loved it. And I mean, I learned so much about how to teach from being there and how to recruit from being there. Because I mean, here I am in the state with the University of Alabama, which, you know, you could teach at the University of Alabama and literally never leave your office. And you're always going to have kids that want to go there because it's the University of Alabama, right? Same thing at Auburn. Mm-hmm. I mean, to a degree. I mean, those guys would probably laugh at me and be like, no, it's hard to recruit. And I know it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jacksonville State is there.
Yeah.
Troy's there. Mm-hmm. South Alabama. You know, I mean, North Alabama. I mean, there are a lot of really great programs in Alabama.
Yeah.
And Samford and UAB.
Right.
I mean, there are 8 strong percussion programs right there.
Yeah.
And trying to recruit people away from the powerhouse programs in that state was not easy.
Yeah.
Especially as a 24-year-old kid that nobody knew.
Right.
You know, so I mean it was hard, but I loved it. Mm-hmm. I mean I really learned a lot about a lot of things. And so when I ended up going to Eastman, I think it was more like in being away from it, I realized just how much I would like to take that same work amount and same work ethic and channel it into the things that I felt like I was really the best at. Like, I was never – I think I did well as a marching band director, and I did it with a lot of passion, and I worked really hard to overcome the fact that I didn't know what I was doing.
Right.
And I learned how to do it. You know, I learned how to get really good at it fast so that I could fool people into thinking that that's what I did full time.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah.
That's what I trained to do.
Yep.
But if I could take all of that energy and all that time and focus it into what I really wanted to be doing, what would happen then? And I right. think that's what being at Eastman really did for me. It's like, okay, I'm spreading this amount of peanut butter on a piece of bread that's 10 miles wide.
Mm-hmm.
What if I took all of that and I really concentrated it on putting it right where it needed to be?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe something magical could happen. And I think that's what it meant to me. It wasn't so much that I wanted to leave the job or leave the students. I loved that place. It was more like for the long term, I didn't see myself being a career person doing that job for my whole life.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do something else. That was only it.
Plus, that's a lot of bread and peanut butter, man. I mean, just an enormous amount.
It was a lot. But, you know, it was tough, but I loved that place. And then Tracy Wiggins came in after me,
yeah.
And then Grant Dalton has been there ever since, and he loves it and is doing a great job.
Yeah.
You know, those guys have – it's really nice to be able to look back on that. And, you know, I was the first percussion teacher there, really.
Yeah.
You know, the first, like, full-time person. It's so great to see the program still going strong and to be so much better than it was when I was there. I mean, that's all that any of us can hope for, right? I mean, especially if you're there at the beginning of something, to realize after you've left that it's way better than when you were there. I mean, that's the whole goal.
Yeah.
So.
Definitely. When you take the Kansas job and then, a few years later, you take the Florida State job, was that a situation where you're like, well, this might be – like the career job?
There were a couple of things that were happening. I love KU too. Mm-hmm. I mean, I loved being there. I loved Lawrence. I loved Kansas City. I loved the students. It was tough to recruit there. I think Kevin did a much better job than I did for a variety of reasons. One, I think we talked about this before. Kevin is just a monstrous player.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've ever got good, God.
Yeah.
And he's just got this infectious personality. And I think it was easier for him to recruit than it was for me. So it was easier for him to grow the studio bigger than I had it. When I got there, I think there were three majors and a bunch of non-majors. And by the time I left, I think there were like 16 majors.
Okay.
So it grew.
Yeah, yeah.
But by the time he left, I think it was significantly more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And the level of player was higher.
Yeah.
But the thing that frustrated me, and I'll never forget this, because what I forgot to tell you about the day that I saw the advertisement was this.
For which job?
When I saw the advertisement for Florida State, I told you the story about when I saw it on my computer that Jeff had sent it to me.
Yeah.
What had happened that day, though, I did not tell you, I don't think. I had spent 3 or 4 days with this kid from Texas and his family. And they came and they hung out and spent, you know, watching lessons and watching ensemble rehearsals and watching all this other kind of stuff, which, you know, is so important for visiting students to do. Not on audition days, like – always go visit when it's not an audition day so you can actually see what's going on.
Right.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, he comes and he hangs out. He finds out he's in at TCU. He's in at Texas. He's in at, you know, blah, 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 fill in great school.
Yeah.
And, of course, we want him. Mm-hmm. It turns out he wants to come to Kansas. But because he's out of state, it's going to be like, you know, whatever, $14,000 a year or something. Right.
Significantly more. Yeah.
So I go upstairs to a person who will remain nameless, who was the assistant chair at the time.
Okay.
And I say, I need money for this kid. Like, we didn't have a whole lot of scholarship money at the time, but I was like, I need a serious amount of money to try and show this kid that we're serious. Cause we could build not only the percussion program around, this is a blue chip player.
Yeah.
You know, that would be a shining light for all of our studios, really. I mean, we need this kid here.
Right.
And look at all these places he got into. He had gotten into Eastman. He had gotten into some other huge place.
Yeah.
And the assistant chair looks at me and he goes, well, if he's good enough to get into Eastman, he's too good to come here. And I just looked at him and I said, what? And he goes, yeah, but he's too good to come here. So you're telling me that we're not going to give him money? And he goes, no, he's going to go somewhere else anyway. We're not going to give him that money. And I'm thinking right there, like the thought balloon above my head is, I am busting my ass to build this program.
Yeah.
And now I've done my part.
Mm-hmm.
Like I've got somebody here who's, not from Kansas, is an excellent player, who's doing all this stuff. I mean, this is the kind of kid that could change this program.
Yeah.
And is going to be a contributor in every sense to every ensemble, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I'm doing my job, and now I've come to you, and I'm asking you to do yours, and you're telling me that he's too good for this program? Nobody's too good for a program, right? I just couldn't believe it. And so, and right then, that's when that email popped up, and that's why I was like, I'm getting that job.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go to Florida State, and I'm going to get that job. And it worked out.
Yeah.
And that was that.
Yeah. And I would assume that that's not a problem that has come up again.
No. I mean, the only job that I applied for was Northwestern.
Right.
And that was it. I haven't been interested in anything else.
Yeah. Just one more thing with the Kansas, not related to that situation, but what was, did you enjoy living it? You were like really in the Midwest at that point.
Oh yeah. I loved it.
Did you? Okay.
I loved it, but I'll tell you what I love more. I love Florida.
Mm-hmm.
I love not having to wear winter gear.
Mm-hmm.
I love being able to jet ski in January,
mm-hmm.
albeit with a wetsuit.
Right.
But I still like I like it how warm it is. I love spring here. I love fall here.
Mm-hmm.
I can tolerate summer as long as I'm on the river. I like Florida a lot, but I did like the Midwest a lot. I do not miss the cold.
Yeah.
But I loved it there.
Yeah.
I really did. I love the school and I love my colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great place, but that part of it was really frustrating. Like, and I think most of my colleagues there felt the same thing. It was just like, it wasn't so much that all of the administration was like that. It's just that the Department of Music at the time was not a valued member of the community at the university. I didn't feel.
Yeah.
Or at least a lot of us didn't feel. And money, it's like every faculty meeting we had was always doom and gloom. There's no money for this. There's no money for that. We'll never do this. We'll never do that. It's right. Just, you come out of an environment like that, and it's just like, God, why do I even – what's the point? It's like we're supposed to go out and do all this amazing stuff, but, like, when it comes time to actually give us the tools to help do our jobs, nobody seems interested in doing it. Now, granted – it's still a great place. I mean, it's still a top 30 institution, and I know that Mike has done an amazing job there. Kevin's done a great job.
Mm-hmm.
Jihei did an amazing job. I mean, it's not that it can't be done. It's just during the time that I was there, it didn't seem like the support for those kinds of students was there. But I think for whatever reason, the other teachers that came after me were able to get the kids at that level.
Mm-hmm.
Either with money or without, or just because they were attracted to the level of player. Because, I mean, Jihei is an amazing player, and Mike is an amazing player, and so is Kevin. I mean, they're way better than I am, but there was just maybe that's what it was that got students more excited about it. I don't know.
Cool. All right, I finished with random ask questions.
Okay.
First, the first question is not necessarily random, but what's an issue in percussion education that most gets under your skin or drives you the most nuts?
Music ed versus performance. What annoys me the most recently, this has always annoyed me, but it's especially been annoying me the past couple of years. And as we get into audition season, this is something that always comes up.
Yeah.
So, when kids come in and you say, what do you want to do? And they say, well, I want to perform, but my band director told me I'd never make it and there are no jobs. So I'm going to be a teacher instead.
Mm-hmm.
That drives me insane.
Yeah.
That drives me absolutely, totally insane.
Yeah.
So that's not necessarily percussion education. That's more like music in general. But anyway, I wrote an article about it. I got really mad last year after one kid said that to me, and I wrote an article about it. But so people can go look if they want. But I don't know. I think those things choose you. You don't go into saying, all right, well, I want to be a surgeon. Well, no, you know what you really should be? You should be a physician's assistant because that's way more your speed. No, if you want to be a surgeon – be a fucking surgeon.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I know there aren't that many jobs out there, but somebody's got to win them.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're not – I mean, it's not like you lose out on life for trying to do something at a super high level. There are other things that you can do that are related. I mean, my God.
Yeah.
I'm not doing what I thought I was going to do when I first started out.
Yeah.
You know, who are these people to tell you that you're not going to make it? Like, that's what drives me crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, how do you tell an 18-year-old kid what you're going to do and what you're not going to be able to do?
Yeah.
I mean, really.
Yeah.
Sure. With some, generally, you can say, okay, yeah, sure, it's tough out there, and there are too many doctoral people, and there are too few jobs, and nobody gives a crap about the arts. Yeah, that, whatever. Mm-hmm. But, hey, there are job openings right now, Pete.
Yeah.
And there are people out there that are going to get them mm-hmm. right now, and yeah. those are going to open other jobs that other people are going to get right now.
Yeah.
Why can't it be you? People told me that it wasn't going to be me, and guess what?
Yeah.
They were wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And they can be wrong about these other people, too.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. All right.
So that drives me nuts.
Yeah. No, I'm with you on that, definitely.
Don't tell me what I can and can't do. Don't tell kids what they can and can't do.
Right.
Until it becomes painfully obvious to all involved.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Like why are you drinking that Gatorade right now, John?
Well, this is because it was in my refrigerator. I don't even know whose it is. So many people keep stuff in my refrigerator. I don't even know whose. I think this is mine.
Okay. Oh, you can figure that out later.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, who's seen my? Anyone have my Gatorade? Like,
where's my Gatorade? I had the blue one, not the light blue one. Yeah. I don't know.
You're just like looking around, like, was it you? Was it you?
No, it's cool. Actually, this floor's janitorial staff keeps their food in my refrigerator, so we have this ongoing joke about, you know, who's going to eat what,
mm-hmm.
just because I love them so much, and mm-hmm. they come by, and we have lunch together sometimes, and they keep all their stuff in here, so sometimes, I drink their stuff, they drink mine, I don't care. I don't know whose it was. It was sealed, though. It's not okay, like, you right. know, half of it's, like, open, yeah. and I'm like, I don't know whose this is. We're sanitary about it.
I got you. All right. So here are a few more. Let's see. Not as serious. Has anyone ever nailed an impression of you? And if so, how did they do it?
I have no idea, but I'm sure it's happened.
Gotcha.
They've never done it in front of me, mm-hmm. so I don't know.
You're waiting, though, right?
I don't. I suppose. I'd probably be really embarrassed, because I'm sure whatever they would say would be embarrassing. Mm-hmm. You know, it would probably be funny to everybody but me, because I would just be mortified that I did or said whatever it was that they're making fun of. That's how it usually works.
Gotcha. All right. What is the most impractical item of clothing you own?
A hand-sewn, rust-colored cummerbund with penguins on it.
All right.
And I've never worn it. My mom made it for me, and I've never worn it because I've never had the opportunity.
Okay.
But I still have it. I've lost like 45 pounds
mm-hmm.
In the past 8 months.
Mm.
And so I got rid of all of my clothes.
Ah.
So, but I did keep that. So it's like the thing that's traveled with me ever since I've had it, even though I've never worn it. So that's like the most random thing I have.
Nice. That's pretty random.
That's pretty random.
Yeah. What is your favorite Michael Jackson song?
Right now, it would definitely be Billie Jean, but it's the Tony Sukar version.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I love this. That album's great.
Oh, my God. Yeah, it's so good. That one especially. I've gotten stopped by cops twice while that's been playing in my car. once for going 75 in a 45, and once for following a highway patrolman too closely in the left lane trying to escape Hurricane Michael.
Oh.
I actually got pulled over. He pulled over. I went past him, and he got back on the road and pulled me over. And I was like, what's going on? And he was like, you're following me too closely. I was like, are you serious? He goes, it's not funny. I said, okay. Both times I had that tune playing in the car. It's dangerous. Tony Sukar is dangerous.
Do not put that music in the car anymore.
No, Dan McGuire turned me onto that stuff. I was working with Science Hill last year, getting them ready for their Midwest show,
mm-hmm.
which they're doing in December. Those guys are awesome, by the way. And Dan and I were just trading music back and forth. He's like, are you hip to this? And after that, I've just been listening to it constantly.
What's a great movie and what's a terrible movie?
I think we talked about A Star Is Born. That's been the most recent one I saw in the theater, which I really loved.
Yeah.
I thought it was great for a variety of reasons. I think just because it's almost Halloween that we have to say that Hellraiser is both one of the best and worst movies ever made.
Oh, my God. Hellraiser. I haven't thought of that in years.
Just because it's part of my ritual every October, it has to be in there. But I think that probably the most perfect movie that was ever made is Alien.
Oh, the original.
The original.
Oh, yeah.
For me, at least. I think between that and Jaws, those, I think, could be my two favorite movies of all time. Like, I don't know if you know Todd, if you know Todd Sheehan at all. He's the timpanist and, well, anyway, he's a really good friend, great, great player. And he and I, for years, anytime Jaws was on, we would just take pictures of it and send it to each other and just start quoting. Like, he and I can quote that entire movie.
Yeah.
No references, no IMDb, no nothing.
Yeah.
The same way that most people can do Wrath of Khan or Tombstone, we can do with Jaws. And so we have a lot of fun with that. I love those two movies. He can also do Alien that way, which is, I think, one of the reasons we're best friends.
Yeah, yeah.
But those are great.
Would you two start singing the song from the boat before some major event?
Farewell and adieu to you fair Spanish ladies.
Yeah, yeah.
Farewell adieu to you ladies of Spain. Yeah, I know it. I have never sung it to him, though. I don't sing in public.
Oh, okay.
I'm like the Von Trapp family. You know, I will not sing in public. My children will not sing in public. I don't know. What would be a really bad movie? I'd have to think about it. I love movies so much. I don't think there's any such thing, really.
Okay.
I don't think there's any such thing. Because even really bad movies are fun because they are so bad. So I don't know. I don't know that there are really truly bad movies. I could be wrong. Right. Manos, the Hand of Fate is largely described as the worst movie ever made. Or it could be, what's the movie that was just made about the worst movie ever made?
Oh, The Disaster Artist.
Disaster Artist. Yeah, I loved that. It was so good. I need to go back and actually watch the original.
Uh-huh.
But there again, like, it's so bad that it's like a cult classic. It's like art. It's so bad.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I might have to check that out. It's kind of like, have you ever listened to The Shags?
No.
Oh, my God, Pete. You've been missing out. Okay. Look up this band. It's called The Shags, S-H-A-G-G-S. It's these three sisters.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going to tell you anything else about it except that it was Frank Zappa's favorite band. All right, look them up.
All right.
And listen to some of that stuff, okay? And it's a perfect example of when things are so bad that they're actually amazing. And see what you think. And listeners, please feel free to email me your thoughts on this. Peyton McDonald turned me on to them, like, I don't know, 20 years ago, and I have never looked back. I mean, it's just amazing stuff.
That's good. I'm happy to hear that. All right. What is your biggest kitchen mess up?
I think probably the biggest kitchen mess up I ever had didn't happen in the kitchen, but it ended there.
Okay.
My oldest son, Gabriel, who's now 10, was probably – 4. And we had this game where he would walk across the room with his hands up in front of him, and he would walk towards me, and then I would kiss his hands when he got close to me.
Okay.
And unbeknownst to me, he had stuck both hands down the back of his pants and had poop on them. And I didn't know this. And so he comes up and he's like, "Dad, dad, dad, dad." And he walks up and I start kissing his hands and realize that there's something on them. So I ran to the kitchen and started gagging and like having like dry heaves and like I'm trying to get everything out of my mouth.
Yeah.
And like I go get a toothbrush and like brush everything out and then throw that toothbrush away. And then, you know, I mean, it's just that all happened in the kitchen. So that's probably the worst kitchen accident I've ever had. So when people say this tastes like shit, they may not know what it tastes like, but I do.
Oh, my God. Oh. Oh, that's a good.
Maybe that's a good place to end this.
I got a couple more to end this.
Okay.
But that's pretty solid. You make a strong case to end everything right there. I'll jump right to this one. What is the strangest, most bizarre, or funniest moment in a performance that involves you?
this was, God, it must have been like 10 years ago, and I was playing the Svoboda Marimba Concerto, which a lot of people don't know. It's gorgeous. I had misjudged how long it was going to take to learn it. I tried to learn it in 8 weeks, and I should have taken like 8 months to learn it, but for a variety of reasons, it was during the Northwestern thing. It was my last semester of tenure earning. Gabriel, my now ex-wife was pregnant with Gabriel. It was a really traumatic time. And I remember right before I went out, I couldn't remember how the cadenza in the first movement went. Like, I just couldn't see it in my head. And so the orchestra is playing, like, Procession of the Nobles was the overture. And I'm literally running backstage to go find a marimba somewhere where I can, like, get down and, like, see how it works out. And I just couldn't figure it out. And so I remember right before I went on stage, I said something to myself that I'm just like, I almost say to myself every time I go out on stage now, I'm just like, fuck it, grip it and rip it. Because I just couldn't remember how it went. And I was like, well, there's nothing I can do about it now. Just make it up, I guess, and see what happens. So anyway, I get out, play through the first movement. I get through the cadenza. Everything's fine. I get through the second movement and start the third movement. And all of a sudden, the lights go out in the hall. All the power goes out in the concert hall, all of it, and it stays out. Because a small Cessna had crashed into a power transformer in the Waffle House parking lot about a mile from the concert hall, and it knocked out the entire city's power grid.
Wow.
So I was like, I escaped. You know, because the worst part was coming up. Like, the rest of the third movement was what I was the most scared of. And, you know, and I escaped it. I was like, woo! You know, I got out of it. And then the next week, I got an email from the orchestra director. We've rescheduled the concert. And I had to go back and, you know, figure it out. But we survived it. But it was just one of those situations where, like, I mean, we've all been there. Like, it's such a horrible feeling when you're getting ready to go on stage and you're not 100% ready to be there. And I fortunately haven't had it that often in my life, but that was one that I definitely remember. And, man, it was just like driving on two wheels the whole time. I barely survived it, but that was kind of a funny thing. I just couldn't remember how something went, and I was scared to death, and then the airplane crashed. So, it's kind of, you know, I don't know. It was like a metaphor, you know? Airplane, crashing of the airplane, all the power goes out. I don't know.
Yeah.
Draw from it, if you will.
That's pretty great. All right. Lastly, what one piece of art, whether it's from music, movies, books, podcasts, YouTube clips, visual art, whatever, has impacted you the most recently?
The thing that I have been the most impacted by recently is the second movement of the Ravel Piano Concerto with Christian Zimmerman playing with the Cleveland Orchestra and Boulez. I think that, to me, is if I had one thing to take to with me to like an alien civilization to explain to them the height of our achievements as a race, that would be it. And what's really special about that recording, if you've never listened to it or anybody else, I mean, if you know that piece, you know how special that second movement is. But what's really special about that particular recording is if you put on your headphones and you listen really closely, Zimmerman, you can hear him singing the melody, and it makes me cry every single time I listen to it. And it's like when you've been through what I've been through in my life, in the last 5-6 years especially, but especially 5 years ago, and realize that you get to wake up every day and you get to listen to something like that and be moved like that. It doesn't get much better than that. There's not much more that can inspire you to do your best every day for everyone around you. And so for me, that's what it is right now.
Oh, man. So great to have had the chance to talk to John for that long. What a gift. I really, really enjoyed it. I look forward to catching up with him at some point in the future and keeping up with his career going forward. And if he so chooses, the path of crotchety, crusty old man, Pete Zambito is here for it. This week's rave is the Alvin Ailey Dance Company. Nearly 20 years ago, in my past life as a grad student at UNCG, the Avenale Dance Company came into town. I knew the name, but had never had a chance to see them. And here was my chance. I should also point out that I was a grad student. And for those of you in the know, that's a time when you do not have much in the way of money. So while it didn't pay a salary, I spent a fair amount of time as a grad student at UNCG ushering for major events for the sole purpose of getting to see awesome concerts for free. And this was one of them. For Alvin Ailey, I even managed to convince my then-girlfriend and now-wife, Rebecca, to usher for the same event. Then we sat and had our minds blown. From that concert, Rebecca still has the event poster hanging in her office, a beautiful dancer photo that is still breathtaking. So, 20 years later, it was a chance to see them again. This time, it was the Ailey 2 Company, a slightly smaller group, but with all the same talent and hard work as usual. And it was so good for so many reasons. Number one, Alvin Ailey's company is loaded with folks who have perfect or near perfect body control. The precision, the speed, the elegance, the technique, it's just operating on a different level. Two, the lighting. Whoever lights these shows needs to just light every single stage performance of anything ever. It's inventive, it tells a story, and it keeps you totally interested. Three, intricate choreography. Specific, yet so general. Ensemble and solo pieces appear together, telling stories. The duets tell stories. The music is combined to make very good sense of what's going on. And the pieces all fit together very well. And four, the level of difficulty. My wife and I commented that there were a number of times that things didn't line up as well as it should for ensemble pieces. Then I realized that the first set of selections were all to 20th century avant-garde music that was frequently untimed, in no particular key, and constantly changed meters. Catching that timing is nearly impossible. And the Alvin Ailey Dance Company made it look effortless and made it enjoyable. I'll let it pass that they did not go ahead and do Revelations. Their epic, monumental, multi-part African-American history set the spirituals. But that's okay. We still got to see them, and they were still phenomenal. If they come to a town near you, make your plans and go see them. And that's our show. Subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, where you can leave a comment and a rating. All show notes and all past episodes can be found at the homepage at petezambito.com/Pete's Percussion Podcast, the episodes. Shows also on SoundCloud and Stitcher. If you're on Facebook, like the page Pete's Percussion Podcast. You can find me there on Instagram and Twitter at Pete Zambito, or by email at petesperkpod@gmail.com, and I'll catch you next time. Until then.